guest speaker for this meeting. He's come all the way from Palmdale, California. Let's give a warm welcome to Hank Jay.
Hi, everybody. My name is Hank Johnson, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm glad to be here today. Thank you very much for asking me. I drank for 30 years. I walked into a bar when I was 18 years old, and they served me without asking me for my ID, and immediately I became a man, you know. I graduated right then and there. I never had to learn another thing for the rest of my life. I knew everything. You know, I always wanted to be a man, and a man can buy a drink, you know. And I enjoyed that bar. They had a jukebox over in the corner, and I could play that jukebox just as good as the rest of the guys. And in fact, I thought my selection of songs were much better than most. And I could sit at the bar and look at myself in the mirror and get better looking after each drink. And I just went back there every chance I got. And for the next 30 years, I drank, you know. And I hear these fantastic stories from the podium about how some of these drunks, you know, what they used to do when they were drinking. Gee, they'd go into a bar and they'd just punch everybody out in the whole place. And then they'd go outside and clean up the sidewalk, you know, and drive cars 80 miles an hour into tunnels and make U-turns and just all kinds of great stuff, you know. You know, all I ever did is just sit around and drink for 30 years. You know, I was going to, but I just never got around to doing anything. I met my wife in a bar. Where do you meet girls, you know? And we moved out to a little shack in Hermosa Beach, West Covina. Don knows about that. And nothing down, naturally. And $56 a month. That included interest and taxes and everything, you know. And those payments would come due at the first of the month. And I'd have trouble coming up with that money, you know, because I used my money to drink. And I figured, well, hell, I'll double up next month. And next month would come along and I'd have to come up with $112. Where am I going to get that, you know? And somehow I would make the payment. We finally sold that place before we lost it. And moved in with my father for free. And I always thought money was my problem. If only she would help me. Instead, you know, when I married her, she had a little girl. And then when we moved to West Covina, she became pregnant. And I didn't start saving for that baby till about a week before it was due. And I drove into a little town, El Monte, and went to the beneficial finance company and borrowed the money for the hospital and doctor bill. And you know, when my son turned 25 and I was sober on the program for a couple of years, I finally got beneficial paid off. It seems like there was always a crisis in my life, you know, and just about the time I get them all almost paid, something would happen and I'd have to go consolidate again. And when I came to AA, I had reconsolidated my debts into one big impossible payment. I sometimes gave Pacific Finance some of my business too, and sometimes at the bank they'd lend me some money, and I'd have all three loans going at the same time. And you know what? I never bought anything. I just paid. I don't know what the hell I was, you know, I don't know what I was paying for. And but she would never help me, you know. And my drinking career, it's just really dull. I just sat around and drank, but it used to irritate my wife. And she started kicking me out of the house after about 10, 12 years of marriage, you know. And she'd come home and be really irritated that I was home and that I was smiling, you know, and a little happy. And so she'd kick me out. And, you know, I was so unworthy, I guess. I never gave her any argument. She'd say, move. I'd move. I'd just pack my stuff and leave, you know. And then a month later, I'd work my way back in the house. And I was in and out, back and forth, you know. And she divorced me 3 times. And finally, the last time, I finally got the message. And I said, okay, you want a divorce? You got it. you know. I'm not going to argue. You can have the house. You can have the furniture. You can have everything. All I want is my stack of 78 records. You know, they're collector items, and I want those. And they're yours. And, you know, she was happy to get rid of them. And I moved to a little place, a little shack, actually. It really was a shack in Hermosa Beach, California. And it was a half a block from the water, you know, and I didn't, that appealed to me. I was going to go down at the beach and jog every morning, you know. And it just was a swell place, you know, for me. And I was going to go on a physical fitness kick, you know. And as far as I'm, you know, as far as I know, they told me the water was down there. I never got down there. Starting tomorrow, I was going to do that, you know. And so a typical day for me was to wake up at 10 o'clock in the morning. I'm already an hour late to work, and I'd get in my car, and I'd break the speed limit on the way to work. I knew by the time I got there I was going to be fired because, you see, I should have worked yesterday. And I left all these papers all over my desk, you know, and some of them were kind of old. And if the boss were to see those papers, why, you know, he might not look too kindly to that. And if he looked in my desk drawer, I was dead. I had papers in that desk drawer. Some of them were months old. They were so old I couldn't turn them in. I'd be fired if I turned them in. And if I didn't turn them in, why, sooner or later it was all going to come down. And today I knew it was going to happen. And I'd get to work and I'd check everything out. Everything's the same as yesterday. And, you know, geez, I could relax. And I'd shuffle papers and I'd make excuses to my customers, you know. And ask, you know, they would call and want to know why they hadn't got what they ordered. And I'd say, you mean to tell me that you didn't get that in the mail? You know, well, really, it doesn't surprise me the quality of help they hire nowadays, you know. And I'll personally take care of that, and I'll put it in the mail today. You can count on that. And if you don't hear within 3 or 4 days, call me again, and let's get this thing straightened out. Thank you very much for calling. You know, and sometimes I blamed it on the computer. That's a good one, you know. You know, you didn't get that in the mail? Jeez, you know, well, we've got this computer, and sometimes, you know, it has a few bugs in it, and I don't know why it didn't kick out that letter. You should have gotten it. I'll personally put that in the mail, you know. Every once in a while now, I'll call some company and ask them, you know, why I haven't got my mail, and they'll give me that story. Well, our computer seems to be broke down. I always wonder what's sitting behind that phone, you know. And maybe I should go into some kind of a 12-step call, you know. And then I'd look up at the clock and, you know, and make excuses for an hour or so. I'd look up at the clock. It'd be 11:45, a respectable time to go to lunch. And I'd go next door to the bar that was conveniently located right next door to where I worked. And they sold martinis over there. And I like martinis. And during the lunch hour, they sold double martinis for $1. You know, the regular martinis were 75 cents. But whoever heard of having one martini, right? So I might as well order the dollar one. Save 50 cents. And believe me, I can use the money, you know. And I'd order that dollar martini, and I'd get to sipping on it, you know. And I'd check the guy sitting next to me. He'd have a 75 center. And I'd kind of check what his glass, you know, against mine. And I'd say to myself, you know, who the hell do they think they're kidding around here? This is no double. It's a little bit larger than the 75 center, but it's not really a double. If it were a double, they'd charge more money. You know, I've been around. I don't know why I'm taken in by these things, you know. And so I better have another one. And then I'd have another one, and then I'd have another one, and then I'd have another one. And then I'd call the office and say, hey, I forgot to tell you, I'm going on a lot of calls this afternoon. Take messages. I'll be back tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. And I'd get in my car, and I'd head towards the beach. And I'd stop at the drugstore, you know, and buy the cheapest bottle of vodka they had in the place, whatever was on sale that day. And I'd get home about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and I'd hang up, and I'm real neat drunk. I'd hang up my clothes real carefully on hangers, you know, so the creases fall properly and everything. And I'd put my pajamas on. And I'd sit on the edge of the bed, and a friend of mine was getting a divorce, too, and he sold me a turntable and 10 speakers. And my whole apartment was about as big as this platform here. And I had a speaker in all four corners, under the couch, behind the drapes, in the bathroom, in the kitchen. And anywhere you could look, there was a speaker. And I'd get home, and I'd change my clothes, put my pajamas on, I'd sit on the edge of the bed, and I'd untap that vodka, that cheap vodka, you know, and I'd take a big jolt out of it. And I'd say to myself, well, you blew it again today. Damn it, you know. I'd put an old record on the turntable. Something like Billy Eckstein singing, Who Can I Turn To? And then I'd give myself a real good talking to, you know. Now, damn it, this cannot continue. You're not the only guy that's ever been divorced. You're not the only guy that's ever had debts, for crying out loud. You know, get to work, do something, you know. And, you know, most guys, when they're in a predicament like you are, I'd say to myself, you know, they get a second job or something, work two jobs, or you know, and they get out of debt, and I'd do something, you know. And I'd have this real bright idea. Yeah, that's what I can do. I don't have to get a second job. I'm in sales. All I need to do is work extra hard. And by God, starting tomorrow morning, I'm going to get up at 6 o'clock. I'm going to get down to that damn office by 7. I'm going to knock out paperwork for a couple hours. And by the time that phone starts ringing at 9 o'clock, I'm going to be ready to do business. And it's all going to be different starting tomorrow. God, that's a terrific idea. You know, that's the solution to my problems. And, you know, when you make decisions like that, you've got cause to celebrate. So I'd have another drink. And I'd play another record, maybe a little upbeat one this time, you know. And then I would get to thinking in my mind, you know, I'd think, if I, you know, if I go down there to the office, I can go down on Saturday. I got a key to the office. I can go down there and catch up on my paperwork on Saturday. And I can even go in on Sunday, you know, and plan my work for the coming week. And, you know, if you're in sales, you know, you make a plan and you plan your work and then you work your plan and your problems are over. And God, I felt good when I make decisions like that and when I have ideas like that. I know that's the solution to my problems. And I can give 1 year of my life up. What the hell? A lot of guys have done that, you know. And so I'll just spend the rest of this year working. And I'm not even going to drink for the rest of this year. Maybe I'll go to a New Year's Eve party and have a couple of drinks, you know. But I'm going to devote this year to play catch-up. And get squared away. Man, that's it. And then I would think, now in my mind, you know, if I do this, I can probably double my income, you know. And then in, say, 6 or 8 months from now, I'll be almost out of debt. And if I continue to work and I have all this money coming in, what am I going to do with all the money? Well, one of the things I'm going to do is I'm going to buy a white Lincoln Continental car. And I'm going to drive it up to that house where she still lives. And on the way up there, I'll stop at the Hallmark card shop. And I'll buy a big, beautiful card, you know, a dollar one, no 25 center, but a beautiful card with a lot of sentimental verse on it, you know. And I'll get a key, gold-plated key to that white Lincoln Continental. And I'll get over on the left-hand corner in small letters, I'll just write, thanks for all the good years, and sign it H. You know, not Hank or Henry, just H. And then I'll put the gold-plated key in with the card in the envelope. And I'll drive that white Lincoln Continental up in front of the house where she lives. And I'll drop the envelope in the mail slot. And the next morning, she'll wake up, and she'll go through her routine, you know. And she'll get her mail, finally, you know. And she'll find that big envelope, and she'll open it, and the key will, oh, I wonder what that key is, you know, will drop out, see. And then she'll read that sentimental verse on there. And she'll look over on the left-hand side, and in small letters, it'll say, thanks for all the good years, H. And then she'll look out on the front you know, and she'll see that white Lincoln Continental out there, and she'll put it all together that that's her car. And then she won't think I'm so damn bad. Yeah. Then she'll be sorry. And I don't know about you folks, but I get a lot of pleasure out of giving cars away like that. So I'd have another drink. I'd look up at the clock, it'd be 10:45. My God, where in the hell has this day gone, you know? And I'd throw my clothes on over my pajamas and run 2 blocks to the liquor store. I'd go in there and get the guy just as he was putting the light out, closing up. My bottle of Smirnoff's. I always bought the better brands there in the local area. I wouldn't want him to think I was cheap. And I could stroll back to my place, you know? And I'd have security and contentment, you know, right there in that bottle for the rest of the evening. And then I'd get back and I'd have dinner, you know, a cold hot dog out of the icebox. And I'd sit at the edge of the bed and I'd drink out of that bottle and play these old 78 records, you know, and continue my fantasy. And I'd start rehearsing the speech I was going to give because I was going to be salesman of the year and I'd have to give a speech at the banquet. And somewhere in there I'd pass out. And I'd wake up the next morning and it'd be 10 o'clock. I'm already an hour late to work. I'd throw my clothes on real fast and shave and get in that car and break the speed limit and get down to work. I knew I was going to be fired because I left all these papers all over my desk. And my God, if the boss saw him, you know, he's really going to give me some heat. I knew it. And if he looked in my desk drawer, for sure I was dead. I was going to be fired. And I'd get there and I'd check my desk out. Everything's the same as yesterday. And I could relax, you know. And I'd make excuses to my customers. You know, you mean you didn't get that in the mail? You know, well, you know, the quality of help you get nowadays. Or I'd blame it on the computer. And in a respectable time, like 10:45, I'd go next door to the bar that was conveniently located right next door where I work. And I'd make my big decision of the day, you know, whether to have the dollar one or the 75 cent. And then I'd have another one, and then I'd have another one, and then I'd have another one. And then I'd call the office and say, hey, I forgot to tell you, but I'm making a lot of calls this afternoon. Take messages. Yeah. And, you know, and then I'd get home about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And I'd hang up my clothes real carefully, put my pajamas on, sit on the edge of the bed and untap this, take a big drink out of it. Put an old record on turntable. You know, something like Billy Eckstein singing, Who Can I Turn To? And then I'd have this bright idea. You know. Starting tomorrow morning, it's all going to be different. I'm going to get up at 6 o'clock. I'm going to get down to that damn office by 7. I'm going to knock out paperwork for a couple hours. When that phone starts ringing tomorrow, I'm going to be ready. And starting tomorrow, it's all going to be different. I'm not going to drink for the rest of this year. I might go to a New Year's Eve party, have a few drinks, but, you know, I can devote 1 year out of my life to work. You know, I'm not the only guy that's ever been into a predicament like this. And hell, you can work your way out of this thing, you know. And then I'd give a Lincoln Continental away. You know, I didn't do that once or twice. I did that hundreds of times. Hundreds of times. And towards the end of the month, the boss would say, are you in sales here, you know? And I'd say, yeah, I'm in sales. He'd say, well, how about making a sale? And I'd say, don't worry about a thing. I'm a fast finisher. And I was, because I was running scared, and I'd work around the clock. And, you know, I always made my quota. You know, they give you a quota. And I always exceeded my quota. And for 8 drunken years in a row, I exceeded my quota, and I got a big, beautiful plaque every year. And it said on there, you know, big, great, big, beautiful, beauty. And it says on there, for outstanding salesmanship, you know, and being the type of, you know, representative that the company's proud of, and for product knowledge and all this good stuff, you know, for 8 drunken years. And then I got sober. And for the next 8 years, I didn't win a plaque. That's how it helped me. Yeah. In fact, after 2 years of sobriety, they fired me. And I walked in one day, and my boss fired me. I says, you can't do that, you know. I've been with this company 10 years now. You know, you can't fire me. The hell I can't. You're fired, you know. And I says, well, I'm going to go down and see the big guy downtown. And I went down and seen him, and I took my fifth step with him, you know. And what I actually did, I sniveled and cried to him, and I said, Jesus, you know, I've worked for this company for 10 years, and I've always, you know, I made honor roll, you know, and I got all this stuff, and I said, you should have really fired me a lot of other times, but now I've completely changed my life, and I don't drink anymore, and I, you know, and I'm trying to lead a good, honest life now, and I've, you know, and trying to be good to my family and all that. And he says, well, gee, that's all very interesting, but they just don't want you to work there at that office, you know. And so he said, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll put you on paid leave of absence. And he says, you say you're a salesman? Go sell yourself to another office. We got plenty of them, you know. So that's what I did. I sold myself to another branch office, and I'm still with that firm. And I've been there now over 20 years, and I'm starting to get a little worried because the last 3 or 4 years I've been winning plaques again. About that time I got a call from my ex-wife, and she said, come and get your drunken son, he's just like you are. And seems he turned 16, and he was getting in all kinds of minor trouble in high school. He's probably one of the kids who are in trouble here, you know. And that's the type of kid he was. Nothing really bad, but he was just into a lot of stuff. And he had gone to a party and gotten drunk. And he came home and threw up on the carpet or something. And it was the last straw. My wife just couldn't cope with him, you know. And so she called me to come and get him. And so he had to come and live with me as a punishment to him. He had to come and live with me. But it was kind of a punishment to me, too, to tell you the truth. Because I didn't know what to say to the kid. You know, he used to come down and visit me occasionally. And I didn't know what to talk to him about. You know, if I wasn't drinking, why, I would lecture him. I would tell him, you know, you should be doing better in school. You should be getting all A's and B's with your potential. My God, you know, you're a smart kid. And as big as you are, you should be the football star, you know, and you should be student body president. And I would give him all this stuff, you know, and he didn't want to hear that malarkey, you know. Or I was drunk, which was more than most of the time I had been drinking, and then I would just slobber all over him, you know, and tell him how much I loved him, and tell him, you know, you're no accident, you know, you were planned, you know, you're a love child, I used to tell him, you know. He used to sit there and just cringe, you know, and I'd say, you know, stuff like, you know, your mother and I have had all this trouble, but it doesn't concern you at all, you know, we love you. And he would just sit there and just couldn't take anymore. He could hardly wait to get out of there, you know. And then the next morning I'd wake up and be ashamed of myself because I told my son I loved him. You know, I couldn't do it sober. And he went home one time after visiting me, and he asked his mother, he says, you've divorced him. Is there any kind of legal action I can take? I don't want to go back there, you know. So as a punishment to him, he had to come and live with me. But, you know, it's a funny thing. We struck up a real good relationship. And you can build relationships if you have something in common with the other person. And we had a resentment. You know, Mom had kicked us both out. So we built from that, and we still got a good relationship going today. And about that time, my ex-wife called me and said she wanted to come down and see her little boy. You know, taller than me, had hair clear down to his rear. You know, he was a surfer. And so she came down and saw him, and one thing led to another, and we got to talking, you know how you do, one thing led to another, and we decided we should try this thing one more time. Only, let's sell that big house. By now we lived in another house. God, we lived in so many houses. But by now we had this nice house in Torrance, and we'd sell that place and use the money to pay off our bills. We just start building. You know how you get excited when you're making plans, you know, it's just wonderful. And she said, I won't even fight you on your drinking anymore. In fact, I'll join you. And I should have been suspicious right there, but I wasn't, you know, because that woman, she never drank. All the years I was married with, she couldn't drink. We'd go to a party or something, and she'd get a drink, you know, and she'd kind of gag on it or something, you know. And I'd try to get her a big, tall glass, and I'd say, here, put a lot of 7-Up in there, you know, and come on, you're at a party, loosen up, let's go, you know. And, you know, you're supposed to be having a good time here, yeah. So when she said she'd join me, it just went over my head. Little did I know that during that 2 or 3 year period that we were apart, she had taught herself how to drink. And you know, you can do that if you practice enough, you know. And she got real good at it. And she could slug any kind of booze down straight and not even make a face when she moved in with me. And so then a typical day was that I'd wake up late and go through my routine, get down to the office late, and check everything out, go next door and have my martinis and call and tell them I was going on calls, and I'd get home about 2 and I'd change my clothes and put my pajamas on, and I'd play a record and go into my plan for tomorrow and the rest of my life, you know, starting tomorrow. And I'd look up at the clock, it'd be like 2:30 in the afternoon, here comes my son. And I'd say to him, you know, who the hell do you think you're kidding, anyhow? It's only 2:30 in the afternoon. School don't get out till 3. And here you are, you know. And I'd stand there in my pajamas with a bottle of vodka in my hand, you know, and I'd ask him, how the hell do you ever expect to amount to anything? You know, if you don't apply yourself in this world, my son, you haven't got a chance. You've got to have a diploma to get any kind of a job, you know. And he'd look at me funny. He always had 3 or 4 guys with him, and they'd look at me funny, and they kept their surfboards down there, you know. And they'd go off surfing. And then I could continue my fantasy a little bit for another hour or so or 2, and here comes my wife. And we'd have our first drink of the day together. Now, you know, if I don't drink, I'm kind of a grouchy guy. I just soon sit in a corner and read a book or watch TV or whatever. And I'm very liberal, you know. You can just do anything you want to do. You know, just don't bother me or ask me my opinion or ask me for any money, you know. If you meet that criteria, you can just do any damn thing you want to do, you know. But you give me one drink, and all that changes. And whoever you are, I like you the best. You're my very favorite person. You're the most interesting person I've ever met in my life. I want to hear your whole story from the time you were born right up till now and what your plans are for the future, you know. And as long as you've got a bottle of vodka or something, well, I'm prepared to sit up all night with you and listen to it. And especially my family. I love them. I really love my family when I'm drinking. You know, I just love them. I can't get enough of them. You know? And I'm really happy when I see my wife come home. You know, I'm just delighted that she's home. Now, she's a very friendly, outgoing person. And she knows the paper boy by his name. She knows the girls at the supermarket, you know, the checkout gals. And she's just outgoing and friendly. God. But you give her one drink, And all that changes and all the pent-up emotions and hostilities of a lifetime come out in that first drink, you know. Talk about Jekyll and Hyde, you know. My God. And she just gets meaner than hell. And I didn't come clear up here to take her inventory, but what the hell, she's not here, I can tell you. A few things, you know. She did stuff like take a hammer to my little Sony TV and just smack it just because I was laughing at a program, you know. And she would go, you know, I'd say, honey, you've just got to listen to this song, you know. And it would be some old 78 record that we've had for 10, 20 years or something. And I'd sit her on the couch, you know, so all those 10 speakers would face, so the stereophonics would hit her properly, you know. And I'd put this record on, you know. And I'd say, now listen to this, you know. And she'd listen to it. She said, hell, I've heard it 1,000 times. Yeah, but doesn't it sound extra good today, you know. You know, here, listen to it one more time, you know. And she'd have another drink, you know, and she'd walked over to the phonograph and took the arm, you know, of that phonograph and just bent it. You know, I couldn't play any more records that day, that night. The next morning I got up and I got a wrench and a hammer and plier. I tried to straighten that metal arm out. I couldn't straighten it out. It cost $35 to get it straightened out. I don't know where she got her strength from. And she did something like throw the Christmas tree, lights and all, out the back door. And you know what? And she, next morning, she never remembered a thing. You know, she said. Yeah. I never heard about blackout till I came to AA, you know. And, you know, I don't know what's worse, not remembering or remembering. I just happen to remember, that's all. But she don't remember any of this stuff, you know. And after one particularly bad argument we had, I'm going to go to my brother's house and stay all night. And when I get back, I expect you gone. You know, I allowed you to kick me out of all those other houses we lived in. But this is my house, you know. I moved here first. Therefore, you get out this time. You know. And we're not married anymore, remember? You divorced me. So you leave this time. And so I went to my good brother's house. I have three, you know. I have one that never drinks. He just reads books all the time. He's studying life. He's 70 years old now, and one of these days he's going to start living it, you know. And then I got another brother that's really a square. You go there on Christmas Eve, and he takes the bottle down from the shelf, and he pours you a drink and tells you, well, Merry Christmas, and you have a drink, and then he puts the top back on, he puts the bottle back up, and you go back next Christmas Eve, and he takes the same bottle. Yeah. And then I've got my good brother. Yeah, my brother that I can go to at 2 o'clock in the morning and knock on the door. And as long as you have a bottle of vodka or something with you, he just pulls you right in. And you can sit up with him all night and philosophize. And I went to see him that night. He seemed like he was living alone. He was having a little trouble with his wife. We just had bad taste in women. But I don't know what it is. And while I was gone, my wife decided to commit suicide. Yeah, and she was always doing that. And like my sponsor said, she tried to commit suicide so many times it was starting to impair her health. And this time, before she did, though, she's in a blackout, see? And so she went into my closet where all my clothes were hanging and just took a knife and just slashed every stitch of clothes I owned, you know. And even took the knife and stabbed my damn shoes. And just ruined everything, you know. Just ruined everything. And it made a shambles out of everything. And then took the rags that she had made and put them around the door and the windows and tried to make this little place airtight. And she went to the kitchen stove and turned the gas on and went to bed. And the next morning she woke up just like nothing happened. And, you know, that old place we lived in was half a block from the water, and the wind used to whistle through those boards, and hell, you could have turned the gas on 10 ovens and never smelled it, you know. So she survived again, you know. And she looked around, she couldn't believe her eyes that she had done what she had done. And I got home about 2 that afternoon with a bottle of cheap vodka. I couldn't believe what she had done. And I told her, I said, you know, a woman like you, you know, you shouldn't drink. You know, I mean, some people can drink and some people can't. You know, you should never drink, you know. And so then my son came home a little later and he saw everything. He thought we were moving again. And there we were. Yeah. Well, we didn't plan it that way. You know, when we got married, we sure as hell didn't plan that one. And, in fact, we tried to make our marriage work. We went to counseling off and on for over 15 years. You know, back, you know, we, in fact, we were going to a new type of counseling for us at that time. We were going to a couples workshop. I don't know if any of you guys have ever gone to a couples workshop, but what they do is, you know, like 3 or 4 couples go, you see, in this room, and then there's a therapist, and the couples cop out on one another. And she would say stuff like, why don't you tell them how you drank a fifth of vodka before I came home from work last night? And I'd say, why don't you tell them how you finished the second bottle after you got home, you know? And I would just, my guts would just be on fire, and I could hardly wait to get out of those counseling sessions, and I hated them, you know? And about the only thing I ever learned in therapy was that my mother-in-law had grave emotional problems. And I was sure of that. And but this therapist one time asked me, he says, you really drink as much as she says? And I said, hell yes. I drink a lot. You know, who wouldn't? You have a wife like her, and, you know, and the children that I've got, my God, and I've got this pressure job. My pressure's going to kill me on that job, you know. And so when I come home from work at night, I have a few drinks. What's the big deal? He said, have you ever thought of quitting? And I said, you're damn right I have. I'm going to quit. And I had. I thought about it every night. Starting tomorrow, I was going to quit. And, you know, so he said, have you ever thought of going to AA? And I said, thanks, but no thanks. I've already been to AA. And I had been to a meeting about 2 years prior to that. It was one of these meetings. I don't know if they do it up here, but some of the meetings down in Southern California, they give chips for various lengths of sobriety. And the leader got up that night and said, anyone here completed their first 30 days of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous? And this guy came tearing up the aisle, you know, and he got his little poker chip, you know, and 30 days on it. And he got to the microphone and he says, my name is Joe Blow. I'm an alcoholic. And he said, I'm really proud of this chip. He said, I've been coming to AA now for about 6 years, and I finally got this 30 days, and I know I'm on my way, and this is a spiritual program, and I know it. And I found God when I walked through the doors of AA, and the lights in the eyes of the people here turn me on and keep me coming back. And I just love everybody here, and it's just wonderful. And after 30 days, just tonight on the way to the meeting here, I got a call from my boss, and they promoted me. And starting tomorrow, I'm the vice president of the company. And it's just wonderful to be sober. And he sat down, and I thought, oh, God, you know. And anyone else? You know, and here comes this little gal, you know. My name is Mary Smith, and I'm an alcoholic, and I'm sure proud to have my 30-day chip here. And I know this is a spiritual program, and I found God when I walked through the doors of AA, and the lights in the eyes of the people here just turned me on and keep me coming back, and I just love everybody here, and my children, after 30 days now, my children are just looking at me with respect in their eyes, and my husband is looking at me with renewed interest. And it's just a wonderful, wonderful way of life, and I just recommend it to everybody. And God love you. I love every one of you. And sat down, you know. And I, oh, jeez, I could hardly wait for that meeting to be over, and I never went back. You know. And so when he suggested AA, I thought, thanks, but no thanks. I've already been to AA. And I thought, I didn't tell him, but it's some kind of a religious organization, and it's a, or a cult or something. And I don't want any part of it. God bless them. It's okay for them if that's what they want, but it's not for me. But I had read an article, I told him, about some stuff called anabuse. And I thought I'd get a hold of some anabuse, and just in case, you know, for the first few days. And I would take anabuse, and if in case I needed a drink or felt I wanted one, I couldn't take it because, you know, according to this article, you get deathly ill if you drink on top of anabuse. And so I'd have that in my system, and I wouldn't be able to drink, and I could prove something to my wife, you know. And so he says, well, that's one way of doing it. And he put me in touch with a doctor, and I called the doctor's office, and the receptionist says, yeah, you can, I said, I'd like to get some anabuse. Fine. Come a week from next Tuesday, and don't drink for 48 hours at least before you come on the appointment. And so I didn't drink for 48 hours prior to the appointment. And I went there, and I said, I'm here to get the anabuse. Oh, yes, the doctor will see you in a minute. And the doctor saw me, checked my heart, my blood pressure. He called me into his office and sat down there by his desk, and he started going into this lecture on alcoholism. And he was saying, you know, that people with the disease of alcoholism have character defects, and that what they do instead of solving their problems tonight, they drink instead. And then they wake up tomorrow morning and they still got the same problems, only now they got a hangover too, you know. And just went on and on and on. And he says, I can give you anabuse, but he says, if what you say is true, if you haven't had a drink for 48 hours prior to coming here, he says, you need never take another drink for as long as you live. Well, you know, I wanted to quit. But that's a hell of a long time. I just wasn't planning on quitting quite that long, you know. I just wanted to prove something to my wife that wasn't the problem. And so he just went on and on and on. And I finally said to him, you know, well, Doc, if you're not going to give me the anabuse, then I guess I better go. How much do I owe you? And he said, I can see I'm not making much of an impression on you. He said, but I'm going to tell you something. Due to the nature of your appointment here today, he says, I assume you have a problem with alcohol. I assume that you've got a problem. And he says, I happen to know a little bit about alcohol problems. He says, my wife's an alcoholic. And he says, we've tried everything. We've tried health farms and sanitariums, and we've tried all kinds of psychiatry and anabuse, and you name it, we've tried it, and nothing's worked. But she's sober right now. She goes to AA. And I recommend that that's what you do. In fact, he says, when you leave here, why don't you drive to the Manhattan Beach Clubhouse and buy the book of Alcoholics Anonymous? And he says, and there'll be no charge for this call. And that's the only thing that guy said that afternoon that impressed me at all. But I did go up and buy the book, and I threw it on my dresser, and then all this happened where my wife tried to commit suicide and everything, you know. And she had been with me, and she had heard all this what the doctor said. So she went back to that doctor and asked him if he thought she was an alcoholic. And he gave her the 20 questions. And she passed an appropriate number correctly to where he says, you know, he says, well, I can't tell you you're an alcoholic, but you should either go to AA or Al-Anon, one of the two. And why don't you go to some meetings with my wife? She'd be happy to take you. And so she came home that night, and she says, I'm going to go to Alcoholics Anonymous with the doctor's wife. I said, oh, my God, what now? You know, jeez. You know, there's always something with you, you know. And so I says, you know, you don't need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. If you just didn't drink, that's all. You know, you shouldn't drink. I grant you that. But you don't need to go to those damn meetings, you know. And I says, besides, what makes you think that the doctor's wife is going to drive down from Palos Verdes in her Cadillac and pick you up here, you know, in this dump we live in? Well, I don't know. I spoke with her this afternoon over the telephone, and she said that she'd meet me here at 7:45. She's going to just toot the horn. She's not going to come in, and she's going to take me to a meeting. And I says, well, just remember what the title of this organization is. It's Alcoholics Anonymous. That means no names. You know, we're not married, remember? You don't have a husband. And I says, well, you know, I just don't believe she's going to come down and pick you up in this dump we live in anyhow, you know. And so about 7:45, this Cadillac drove down and tooted the horn in front of this dump we lived in and picked her up and whisked her off to a meeting. And the first thing they told her in AA was that it's not her fault that I drank. You know, they could have told her 100 other things. But that's the first thing they said. They said, you know, don't take that guilt. Don't take that guilt. You know, you don't have that kind of power. You can't make anybody drink. If they don't want to drink, they're not going to drink. So don't take that guilt. Don't carry it around with you. You know. And also, you can't make him quit. So don't even bother trying. Don't pour his booze down the sink because he'd just go get another bottle. You know, we don't have that kind of power over people, they told her. But if you think you've got some kind of a problem with alcohol, maybe you should come back to these meetings and apply these principles to your problem. And just let that SOB drink himself to death. That's what he wants to do. It's his life. And she kind of liked the ring of that. And so she started going to meetings, and things got better immediately around our house, you know. And if there's two alcoholics living in the same house, if one of them doesn't drink, it's better than if both drink, believe me. And so she went to meetings every night, and I got to stay home and watch TV, any program I wanted to without an argument, and play records and make plans for tomorrow. You know, and all these things, just wonderful life, you know, just terrific, you know. And she quit. And every once in a while, it'd be a good guy, I'd go to a meeting with her. And, you know, I heard some terrific speakers, you know. And I loved the speakers. And I wondered how much they paid the speakers, you know. And so I figured maybe, you know, after I caught the hang of it a little bit, maybe I could go to a little meeting and maybe pick up $25 or something. And, you know, I needed the money bad, you know, but I loved the speakers, and they were very entertaining. But these meetings that she was going to, it seemed like those same two people were at every one of those meetings. And what it appeared to me that they were saying is the same damn thing over and over again, you know. And Joe Blow, by now, he had 90 days or so, you know. And my name's Joe Blow, and I'm an alcoholic. I found God when I walked through the door. The lights in the eyes of the people here turn me on, keep me coming back, and I just love everybody here and these 12 wonderful principles that we live by here. It's just wonderful. And he said, I just got word I've been made a full partner, you know, at the firm, and I'm going to Europe tomorrow, and my Mercedes is being delivered next week, and it's just wonderful, wonderful life. And God, I hated that guy, you know. And then Mary Smith, by now she's got a halo practically. And my name's Mary Smith, and I just so delighted to see all you young people out there. You know, you haven't had to suffer like the rest of us, and it just. Please just keep going to meetings. And I found God when I walked through the door to AA. And the lights in the eyes of the people here just turned me on. I just love all of you. And it's just marvelous here. And I'd like to announce right here in front of all of you that my husband and I are a couple again. And we're going to go on a little honeymoon starting tomorrow. I couldn't stand it. And then afterwards, we'd all hold hands and say the Lord's Prayer. And by then, I could hardly wait to get out of there, you know. But that's not the end of the meeting. Because there's another meeting that goes on after the meeting is over. You know, that's where everybody talks and nobody listens, you know. But the ladies used to come up to me and say, "Are you Lou's husband?" And I'd say, "Yeah, I'm Lou's husband." "Well, are you an alcoholic too?" And I'd say, "No, I'm not an alcoholic too. I'm a visitor here. You know, she's one. I'll work on her, I'll tell you." And so, make a long story short, I finally realized that I was an alcoholic. You know, I kind of suspected it from the first minute. And I told her, I says, "Well, you got me there. I guess I am. I'm one, you know. But I said, I'm not going to go to these meetings. I can't stand them, you know." And I says, "But I'm going to quit." And I quit, you know. And I quit a little before Thanksgiving. And I didn't take a drink clear through Christmas, you know, holidays. And I bought presents for the family. I didn't disgrace anybody by being drunk, you know. And got through the holidays. And the Saturday night after Christmas, my wife went off to a meeting, and I stayed home, and she no sooner left, and I thought, geez, I should have went with her. And I started getting nervous and pacing the floor, you know how you do, and I got to thinking of how good I'd been, you know, over the holidays. You know, I didn't disgrace anybody or get in any trouble, and I bought presents and everything, but I was nervous, and so I went to the liquor store and I bought the Sunday paper. You know, and you can, you know, I don't know if you guys know it or not, but you can buy the Sunday paper on Saturday night if you know where to get them. You can get them at liquor stores; they sell them there. So I went to the liquor store and bought the Sunday paper on Saturday night, and while I was there, I picked up a half pint of vodka. And I no sooner got it back to the place, and it was gone. What the hell did I buy a half pint for? I went back and got a fifth. Went back and got another fifth. I drank all Saturday night and all day Sunday, and up to 2 a.m. Monday morning. Yeah. And I woke up 10 o'clock next morning. I'm already an hour late to work. I knew by the time I got there I was going to be fired. Because you see, I had all these papers all over my desk. And if the boss were to find those papers, I knew I'd... God forbid if he looked in my desk drawer. And I got to the office and everything was the same. And I shuffled papers and made excuses. I went over to the bar. It was conveniently located right next door to where I worked a little early that day. And I ordered a Bloody Mary. And, you know, that's what you order when you're sick. That's not really a drink, you know. Don't mistake that for a drink, you know. That's just medicine is what it is. And so I ordered this glass of medicine, a Bloody Mary. And the guy got a big, tall glass, and filled it full of shaved ice. And he put a shot of vodka, some tomato juice, Worcestershire sauce, and Tabasco a little bit, and some salt, and squeezed the lime in it, and then he stirred it, and I thought he'd never get the damn thing made. And he finally got it made, and I picked it up, and I just drank it straight down, and I, nuts, I slurped it all for myself. And I went to the restroom. On the way, I said, "Hey, make me another one." And I went to the restroom and cleaned up and came back, and he said, "Did you want another Bloody Mary, or did you want a martini?" And I said, "I'd just skip it." And I went over to the coffee shop section of this bar, and I had a sandwich and a glass of milk, and I haven't had a drink since. And I didn't know that was my last drink. And in fact, it was like 2 weeks later, and I realized, you know, that I hadn't had a drink. And I can't tell you for sure why I didn't take that second drink. I kind of think I know. I feel that maybe God tapped me on the shoulder that day and said, "Hank, you've had enough for a while, you know." But anyway, after 2 weeks of sobriety, anger set in. And here I was, 48 years old. I had just completed 30 years of drinking. I had this terrible wife. I got the worst kids in the world. I got a pressure job. My God, the pressure's going to kill me on that job. I owe everybody in town, you know. And when the phone rings, I jump clear across the room because I know it's a bill collector. If anybody knocks on the door, it's a sheriff, I'm sure, here to arrest me. And I don't know what I've done, but I know I'm guilty, whatever it is. And I'm prepared to go, you know. And now they've even taken away my booze. What am I going to do with the rest of my life? You can't go to a decent restaurant ever. You go to a nice restaurant, what's the first thing they ask you? Would you like a cocktail before dinner? You can't say to them, you know, well, yeah, I'd like one, but you see, I've got this disease. You know, and it's of a twofold nature. You know, it's an allergy of the body coupled with an obsession of the mind. If I even take one drink, I can't predict my behavior, you know. If it wasn't for that, I'd sure like to have one. You know, I used to think you had to explain all that stuff to people. You know? In fact, if I was standing on a street corner and somebody walked up, and I'd start explaining what I was doing there. I just had to do an awful lot of explaining back then. You know? And that's one of the freedoms that I've gotten in AA. I don't have to make nearly explanations I used to. And it's not true anyhow, you know, because I went to a nice restaurant just recently, and the waitress came up and said, would you like a cocktail before dinner? And I just said, no thanks. And you know what? It didn't even faze her. She just went to the next table and asked them, and they did. I always check, and they always do. But you know, one of the cruelest things that I've learned in AA, in my whole life, matter of fact, is they don't give a damn if you drink or not out there. You know? And that was one of my biggest worries when I got sober. If I were to quit drinking, what are they going to say? Well, they don't give a damn whether you drink or not. That's the awful truth. You know? You know, they're just indifferent as hell about it, you know. I showed up at work at 8:45 Monday morning. Yeah. My boss walked in, and he said, hi, Hank, and he went into his office. Just like nothing happened, you know. There I was. You know, did he have any idea of the sacrifice that I had gone through to get there at 8:45 on a Monday morning, you know? They don't care. They don't pay you. I found out they don't pay you for getting to work on time. They pay you for what you do after you get to work. And to bring you up to date, time's getting short here. To bring you up to date, I'm sober 12 and a half years. And my wife... My wife is sober 12 and a half years. Almost. Because I've got time on her. How could that be? You know, she went to Alcoholics Anonymous first, right? Well, she didn't hear the part about the pills. And, you know, they talked about the pills. But she thought they were talking about the kind of pills that you smuggle in from Mexico in your hubcaps. Yeah. Not prescription drug. Yeah, her sponsor said. Yeah, prescription drugs too. And so I took my last drink on December the 20th, I hope. December the 29th, 1969. She flushed her pills down the toilet January the 1st, 1970. A whole year different. And she changed her sobriety date, and I've got time on her, and I never let her forget. And this kid that was looking at me so funny, you know, part of the reason he was looking at me so funny was that he was stoned out of his gourd. Seemed like he had a drinking problem, an LSD problem, and a marijuana problem, and any kind of drug problem you can think of, he had it. And I didn't know it. I wasn't aware of it. And when he was 21, he turned himself into AA. And he just took a 9-year cake on May the 27th. And our daughter is on Al-Anon, and she's the secretary of a group in Tujunga, California. You know, and we're an AA family, and we weren't any kind of a family 12 years ago. You know. And every once in a while, all four of us get in the same house together, which is a miracle. And we actually sit across a table and converse, just like we were real people or something. And it's marvelous. You know. And sometimes I cry the bad mouth, and I never had it so good. And I every once in a while, I have to remind myself of that. You know. And my son is a very successful young man. He makes twice the money I do. He drives a BMW car and has a condominium in the San Fernando Valley and just married a beautiful girl, and I just resent the hell out of him. You know, but I try not to say anything to him. You know, but he just hasn't had to suffer enough, that's all, you know. But I try not to say anything to him because I figure maybe if I ask him real nice, he'll let me use his car sometime. He spoke at a large conference in Southern California here 3 or 4 years ago at the Palm Springs Desert Roundup. He was the young people's speaker there. And he stood up at the podium, on the stage, a big auditorium there, and there was like 1,000 people or 2,000 people, I don't know. And he had a beautiful new suit on, he had his hair cut, you know, shaved. And he really looked good, you know, a nice tie. And he stood up at the podium, and my wife and I were sitting out in the audience, and he said, "My name is Matt Johnson, I'm an alcoholic, and I also use drugs." And he says, "I'm the son of a drunken mother and a drunken father." And my wife and I just looked at each other, you know, and tears just rolled down our cheeks. We were so proud. And I don't have much of a message. I tell you, the only thing I've learned in AA, I'm a slow learner. But I know one thing for sure, is that I found God when I walked through the door. And the lights in the eyes of the people turn me on and keep me coming back.